Okay, so this is where we ended up. Last week we talked about the Amal and who he is and what he represents and the contrast between the worldview of the Amal and the worldview of the Ne'er Natan, essentially the difference between the one who kind of, whose faith in God is so dramatic and so strong that he kind of absolves the human being of all sense of responsibility. God is totally in control of everything, and therefore we have no responsibility at all other than to receive the world and enjoy the world that God has created. And the contrast to that was the world of the Amal, which is the exact opposite. Right? Man is at the center of the universe. Man is the one who is in control. Man is responsible for the world around them. And we even kind of had that contrast between the responsibility, who is responsible for tzedek. Ultimately, the main theme that this part of Kohelet deals with is responsibility for good and evil, reward and punishment, tzedek in the world, justice in the world, and ultimately who is responsible for that. In the world view of the Amal, it is man who is responsible for that, and in the world view of the Ne'er Natan, it is God who is responsible for that, and that God will judge, but not in this world, rather in the next. We looked at that in detail in Perek Gimel, when we talked about this phrase, l'kozman ve'et l'chochefetz tachat ha-shamayim, for everything there is a time and a season, and then ultimately his resignation, that when it comes to the world of tzedek and resha, marti ani b'libi etzet tzedik v'yata resha yishbot elokim, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, but he will judge them there, sham. Sham meaning the next world, not in this world. This world there might be injustice, but nothing we can do about it. To which the Amal responded harshly, if you are not going to do anything about the tears of the oppressed, then this is not a world that has of any value. And ultimately, the foundation of his philosophy is, if there is no accountability for good and evil in this world, then what are we being judged for in the next world? Right? If man is really totally controlled and predetermined in all their actions. So that's more or less the contrast between these two views, the Ne'er Natan in chapter 3, the Amal in chapter 4, and we are starting chapter 5 today, but I owe you a postscript, a one-verse postscript. Verse 17 of chapter 4, Shemur raglecha kasher telecha beit elokim, this verse really belongs in the next chapter. And this is sort of one of the clearest indications that the division of chapters of Kohelet has really hard to understand at times. There are other books of Tanakh where it's much more logical. Here it's not. I'm not clear exactly why. Something I'm going to spend a lot of time on, just to recognize that verse 17 begins the next unit. And you'll see that both in style and substance, that it belongs to the next chapter. So I'm going to read through the next piece, and then we're going to focus today on one particular aspect of it, and we'll build it from there. Shmur raglecha kasher telecha beit elokim. Guard your steps, meaning guard yourself, watch yourself, be careful, as you enter the house of God. Karov lishmoa mitei taksilim zavach. It is better to listen, or for you to draw near to listen, depends how you read the word karov, right? To listen, rather than to give sacrifice to fools. Ki enam yodim lasot ra, because the fools don't even know they do evil. And you're better off listening and approaching than bringing sacrifice of fools. I'm not going to explain every text because I want to get the whole picture, and then we'll go back and take it apart piece by piece. Chapter 5. Al tivahel al picha. Don't be rash with your mouth. Belibcha al yimaher lotzi davar lifnei elokim. And don't let your heart be hasty to utter words against God or before God. Ki elokim b'shamayim yata la'aretz. God is in the heavens. You are here on earth. Alken yud varecha me'atim, therefore let your words be few. Be careful. Iba chalom berov inyan, v'kol ksil berov dvarim. Because as a dream comes with a multitude of cares and issues, so a fool's speech with multitude of words. So therefore, you're better off guarding your words and having fewer words, because the fool comes with multitude of words. Kasher tidor neder le'elokim al te'achel le'shalmo. Ki ein chefetz baksilim et asher tidor shalem. You vow a vow to God, don't delay, don't defer, don't tarry in paying it off. For God has no pleasure in fools, he has no desire in fools. That which you vow, pay up. Et asher tidor shalem. Tova shelo tidor misha tidor velo teshalem. It's better that you not vow at all than that you should vow and not pay. Al titen et picha lachti et b'sarecha. Don't let your mouth lead you to sin. V'al tomar lifnei hamalach ki shegagahi. And don't protest or say before the angel that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? When a multitude of dreams, there are vanities and many words. But rather fear God rather than all of these words that are useless and foolish. Moshe, Rash, the Gezer, Mishpat Vatzedek Tireh Bamdina. If you see oppression of the poor and violence and injustice in the Medina, Al Titma Lachefetz, don't be dismayed at the matter. Ki Gavoh Me'al Gavoh Shomer Gavohim Alehem. Now, I'd take issue with this translation. And we'll see why. But it all depends on how you translate it. But for now, I'm going to translate it as ki gavoh me'al gavoh shomer, for higher than high. Higher than high. Gavoh me'al gavoh. Guards, and they are the high ones guarding over them. I'm going to explain that phrase today in a few minutes, but this is our key phrase for today. We'll explain it, understand it. But I'm not sure I agree with that translation, but we'll move forward. Bitron Eretz Bakolhu Melech L'Sadeh Ne'evad. A king who makes himself servant to the land is an advantage to the land and to all. Ohev Kesef Lo'iz Bakesef. One who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. Mi'oheb Be'amon Lo'tua. One who loves abundance, it will not increase. Gam Zahava. With goods increase, those who eat them increase. What advantages to their owner, except to feast on them with one's eyes. Mitukash nata oved, sleep of the laboring man is sweet, whether little or much, whether he eats much or little. But abundance of the rich does not allow him to sleep. I'm going to stop here. These last three verses are somewhat questionable as to who says them. For our purposes, I'm going to assume they are part of this discussion. Not clear. But what's for sure clear is that from verse 12, Yesh ra'a chola ra'iti tachat ha-shamesh, there's a grievous evil which I see under the sun. That's already a new conversation, a new topic, a new focus. That is actually very different from what we've had up until now. And so I'm going to assume that from verse 12, we have a new speaker. That's the basic structure. Okay. So coming back to our question, and it's hard to see this all as one piece because it covers over two chapters, but from the end of verse of chapter 4, Shmor raglecha kasher telecha be'et Elokim, guard your steps, be careful as you come into the house of God. Karov lishmo, approach to listen rather than to bring sacrifices of fools. From that point, al tevehel al picha, don't be rash with your mouth. Don't let your mouth speak against God. Ki Elokim b'shamayim v'ata al haaretz, God is in the heavens, you are on earth. This is already all a new approach, a new speaker, a new perspective. So we've encountered the Amal, we've encountered the Nenatan. We have two other personalities left in Kohelet that we haven't yet met. One is the Yirei Elokim, and the other is the Chacham, the philosopher. of the two, which one seems to be the speaker in this particular passage? I think the answer to that is pretty clear, right? If you had to pick between the philosopher and the one who fears God in this particular passage, who would you choose?
Who fears God?
Right. This is a first introduction to the Yirei Elokim. And because the Yirei Elokim is, quote unquote, the hero, if you will, of Kohelet, he's the one who has the last speech, the last word in the book. Essentially, the text revolves around the perspective of the Yirei Elokim and the antagonists to him, which are the Amal, the Yirei, and the Amal, the Nehnetan, and the Chacham. So understanding the Yirei Elokim is crucial because he's sort of, that's where the centerpiece of the story takes place. And actually, we could do it in sequence, but if I do it in sequence, it'll be much harder to understand the text. So what I'd like to do, with your permission, is I'm going to focus on one particular aspect of his speech. We're going to explore that dimension today, and the rest of it we will piece together from that anchor as over the next couple of shiurim, which, as I said, will take place in the beginning of December. But what is clear is that there are two indications that our speaker has changed. And when this is not the Nehnatan, and this is not the Amal that we have seen. Two dramatic indications that our focus, our speaker, our voice has changed in this speech or in this parak. One is something which we've talked about in the past. There is certainly in the first half of Kohelet, there is a consistent pattern related to the form of speech. First person, second person, third person. More or less, the Nene, who kind of sees himself as the one receiving a world given to him by God, speaks in third person. God is in control. God runs the world. Everything has a time and a place. I'm just here for the ride. God speaks about the world out there. The Amal, whose job it is to take responsibility for the world, for the most part, he speaks in first person. I, what I do, what I build, what I create, I can't live in a world that you, the Nehenatan, have absolved of responsibility, etc. What form of speech is this chapter in? And again, you have to go back to the last verse of the previous parak, but it's essentially you can see it here too. Shmor aglecha kasher talecha bet elokim. Guard your steps when you go into the house of God. Whoops, I keep doing that. Al tevel alpicha. Don't be rash with your mouth. Your heart. Don't let your heart be hasty to utter things before God. You are on the earth. God is in the heavens. What form of speech are we talking about here?
Second person.
Second
It's
person.
clearly second
Second
person.
person.
Second person. He's giving advice. He's speaking to us, the reader, and he's giving, or to somebody else, and he's giving counsel. He's telling, he's speaking. He's giving Musa. And that we haven't seen. We haven't seen that in the Nehnatan, and we certainly haven't seen it in the Amal, the entire world revolved around him. Here he's giving Musa. He's speaking to us, and he's telling us, don't be this, don't be that, you should do this, you should do that. This is something that's foolish. This will be to your detriment. Don't let your mouth let your lead you to sin. Al titen tpicha. Right? If you see injustice in the world, don't be dismayed. Don't. Right? This is a resolution. So really, this is clearly the both second person and counsel and advice are indications that this is not the same as we had before. On top of that, the messaging here is all about God and man, the temple, the Beit Elokim, the neder that you make to God, not to delay paying that neder, the relationship with God. God is in the heavens, you are in the earth. Don't be critical of God. This is very God-centered. So between being God-centered and the sense of second person and the style of giving Musar and counsel and advice, all of this is clearly a different voice. And not only is it a different voice, it's a voice that sounds familiar to us. In what context are we familiar? And if you're not familiar with this book of Tanakh, that's fine too. But in what other book of Tanakh do we have this sense of a book that's designed to give musar, to speak constantly in second person, to give advice, religious advice?
Mishlei.
This chapter reads like it could be pulled right out of Mishlei and Bogel. Copy, paste, boom. Mishlei is a fascinating text. And we're not going to study Mishlei in this course because we're doing Qohelet. But it's important to see the structure of Mishlei because as a structure, Mishlei has a very, very consistent structure. So I'm just going to jump to Mishlei for a moment. And these are, Mishlei has two beginnings. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Mishlei has starts Mishlei Shlomo ben David as an introduction. This proverbs or statements of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, and to know wisdom and instruction, discerning, understanding, etc. We'll talk about that in a second. But Mishlei has a second introduction. Where Mishlei starts essentially twice in chapter 10. We again encounter Mishlei Shlomo. The Proverbs of Shlomo. So why there's two introductions to Mishlei is, if you've ever studied or read Mishlei, it's important to note, chapters 1 through 9 are an introduction. They form a single unit, introduction to the book. Chapters 10 through 30 are essentially the content of the book. So that's just it's a very long introduction, but nonetheless it is what it is. If I go back to the beginning, and you'll notice, besides the fact that it's all in second person, Shema is very famous, Pasuk Chet. Shema b'ni Musar avicha. Listen, my son, to the Musar, to the instructions, to the admonitions of your father, and don't forsake your mother's teachings. Everything in Mishlei is built around couplets. Right? Every Pasuk in Mishlei is built around two phrases that essentially say the same thing. That's classic biblical poetry. But the notion of who is he speaking to? That's my question. Who is Mishlei speaking to? Who is Shlomo in this text addressing? And the answer is B'ni, son.
B'ni, Rachava.
Who is his son? It's not Rachava. The question. That's a whole conversation. Who is his son? But Shema B'ni, his notion, and the entire book revolves around the conversation with his son. B'ni, Pasuk Yud, B'ni, im yifatucha chatim al tavo, if sin entices you, don't consent. He's talking to his son. B'ni, Pasuk Tedva, B'ni, al telech b'derech itam, don't go with them. Keep your foot away from their path. Minar aglacham minitivatam. Then if you start to go through the chapters, just quick glance. Chapter 2 begins with B'ni, im tikacha marai, B'nai son. Chapter 3, B'ni, Tarati al tishkach, don't forget my teachings. Chapter 4, Shimu banim, my sons, right? Chapter 5, B'ni, lechochmati akshiva, listen to my wisdom. Chapter 6, B'ni, imhafti l'rayacha. Chapter 7, B'ni, shmo amarai, over and over again. The structure of Kohelet, of Mishlei is clearly revolves around a kind of what we would call in modern terminology almost an ethical will, right? Instructions, values, messages to his son. And that's where it comes to. Mishlei is a fascinating text. You know, there are lots of works of philosophy and wisdom in the ancient texts of civilization, contemporary to Tanakh and later. What makes Mishlei unique is probably more than anything else, is the phrase, Yirat Hashem Reshit Dat, or Reshit Chochmah. The notion that wisdom is interconnected to the notion of fear of heaven. The notion that wisdom isn't just its own exercise, philosophical exercise, but infused with faith and knowledge from God, Yirat Hashem Reshit Dat, or Reshit Chochmah, as he says somewhere else in Mishlei. The notion that fear of heaven, fear of God, kind of infuses that wisdom, that makes it not just words of wisdom, but Musar and Torah, Right? That makes it a very different kind of exercise. So that's the essence of Mishle. Kohelet doesn't talk to his son. And Kohelet, and this whole discussion, which he wrote first, assuming the authorship of Shlomo HaMelech, which he wrote first, most Mepharshim suggest he wrote Mishle earlier, and then Kohelet at the end of his life, and more or less, I think that fits the perspective, but I'll just show you an interesting observation. He never says the word, my son, in this chapter, but he's clearly talking to somebody in a Mishle-isk style, which would make sense to be referring to the same subject of Sefer Mishle, but I will show you a verse in chapter 12. If I jump to Kohelet, chapter 12, the end of the book, let's look what we find in Pasuk Yubet. Yeter mehema bni yizaher, asot svarim harbe ein ketz v'lag harbe yigat basar. Furthermore, my son, be admonished, of many books there is no end, of much study there is weariness of the flesh. Sof tavar kol nishmat elokim yirah mitzvotav shemor, ki zeh kol adam, at the end, all has been said and heard. Fear God, keep his commandments, that is the whole duty of man. I could take Pasuk Yud Bet and Pasuk Yud Gimel, copy it, paste it into Mishle, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
So, I always felt that this was like a tshuva, because he lived such a crazy life with lots of contradictions, and afterwards he could write things like Mishle and Shir HaShirim.
Maybe. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about whether Mishle and Shir HaShirim were written in the early part of his life or latter part of his life. Chazal say he wrote Shir HaShirim in his youth. He wrote Mishle when he was a little more mature, and he wrote Kohelet at the end of his life. It doesn't really matter from a perspective of understanding the text for our purposes. The reason I wanted to connect it to Mishle was because the notion of Mishle's anchor, more than anything else, in the sense of Yirat Hashem, right? That's the real contribution of Mishle, is that he infuses Yirat Hashem into the sense of knowledge and wisdom and understanding. That is the calling card of the Yirei Elokim in Kohelet. The identity of Kohelet's Yirei Elokim is the one who believes that wisdom has to be anchored in a faith in God and a revealed wisdom from God before you can add to it the wisdom of human experience. That's the foundational difference between the Chacham philosopher and the Yirei Elokim philosopher in Kohelet. And that you see here in Mishle. And so that's really the tell, if you will, the strongest tell that we are dealing with the Yirei Elokim is this notion of a second person Musar's Mishle style and the reference to Yirat Elokim, fear of God, reverence for God as part of that conversation. The other piece to it is if you go back to Pasuk Yud Zayin, from the beginning of this speech, he's talking about Beit Elokim. He's talking about the temple. And given the notion of how much the concept of Gan Eden and the Beit HaMikdash played a role in kind of the beginning of Shlomo's process or journey, it's not surprising that the very first time we encounter the words house of God, temple, sacrifices, role of temple, everything related to the temple, neder to the temple, etc., everything about the Beit HaMikdash, the very first time we should encounter such a thing is in the words of Kohelet. That is not, in the words of the Yirei Elokim, that too is not a surprise to us. So to take a step back for a second, I have three voices so far, and each speak in a different form of speech or voice. The Nehneh speaks in third person. The world is out there, and I'm along for the journey. The Amal speaks in first person. I'm in control. And the Yirei Elokim, who's giving Musar based on Yirat Elokim, Yirat Hashem, he speaks in second person Kohelet style. Mishle style. Okay, that's the first principle. The second principle is, I want to draw our attention to Pasuk Zion, and we're going to spend most of our time trying to decipher the deeper meaning of this verse. If you see oppression of the poor, violence, injustice, persecution of the righteous, if you see all of that in the nation, in the country, don't be dismayed at the matter, because the higher than high, the hierarchy guards over them and watches them. So I'll come to the hierarchy in a moment, but first, what does this phrase remind us of? This has a kind of resonates with us. Why is the language here familiar? The theme of this text is familiar to us. We've seen it. Right? We've seen it several times. Most dramatically, we saw it in the language of the first time we encountered it was in the language of the Nehenel, the Nehenatan, back in chapter 3. When he said, and I'm going to jump us to chapter 3 for a moment. When the Nehenatan was faced with the question of how do you take a theory about absolving man of all responsibility because he's there to receive a world created and run by God, says the same voice. Additionally, what do I do with Makom Mishpat, Shama HaResha, Makom HaTzedek, Shama HaRasha? What do I do with injustice, with wickedness, with perversion of justice? What do I do with, in the language of chapter 5, Oshek, the oppression of the poor, Oshek Rash, and Gezel, stealing, Gezel Mishpat VaTzedek? What do I do with injustice in the world? To which the Yireh, the Nehene in chapter 3 said, Amarti ani b'libi et hatzadik v'et harasha yishpot ha'elokim. God will judge the righteous and the wicked. Ki et l'chol chifetz v'yal kol ma'asev, because there is a time and accountability for every matter. Where and when? Sham. There. And that was the first time we encountered the idea that ultimately there will be accountability for man's actions, but that is God's responsibility and God's responsibility in the next world, not here. We live in the world tachat hashamayim. We live in the world here. God will take care of the issue of justice in the next world, sham. And we spent some time talking about what that means. Then we run to the Amal. Now, the Amal doesn't formulate his philosophy in these terms. Okay? He doesn't use this language. But he does use a language, does address the question, right? He raised the question of Dimata Ashukim, the tier of the oppressed, which the Yireh Elokim refers to when he talks about Oshek Rash, right? Oppression of the poor. So he raised the question of the tier of the oppressed and said, if you're going to throw responsibility up unto God, that has no purpose here. And so he had a different philosophy, namely, his solution was to expand responsibility for the world, not just by one, but by two or by three, Tovim Mishnayim, Chutam Mishulash, Lobim Merayinatek, until finally you end up with the responsibility for this world on the shoulders of the king, society, the Medina, Melech. And that too challenged Shlomo, but challenged him more on the practical side rather than the theoretical side. Theoretically, if I could formulate a verse that doesn't appear in Kohelet, right? If I could do that, which is a little bit chutzpahdik on my part, but if I could formulate a verse that doesn't exist to the world of the Nehenatan, who said, "Et tzaddik ve'et harasha yishpot elokim sham," the righteous, the wicked will be judged by God there. The Amal took the perspective of, if I could create a pasuk that doesn't exist, et tzaddik ve'et harasha yishpat hamelech tachat hashemesh, or kan. Right? The righteous and the wicked will be judged by the king, because that's the job of the king. That's the job of the melech, to take responsibility for the world and to establish it here. Tachat hashemesh. And it all revolves around this dimata ashukim, the tear of the oppressed. Who is going to wipe away, to bring comfort, right? En lehem menachem, says Kohelet, en lehem menachem. Who is going to comfort the oppressed or take responsibility for the oppressed, says the Amal, God, sorry, says the Nene, God in the next world, says the Amal, man in this world. So far, so good? Comes along Kohelet in chapter, the Yirei Elokim, in chapter 5, and introduces us to the same question. If you see oppression of the poor, the tear of the oppressed, if you see the stealing of justice and righteousness, if you see injustice and wickedness in this Medina, in this world, notice the use of the word. The word chefetz here, it's not an accident. It jumps us back into the world of the Amal, the world of the Ne'eneh, who talked about Kozman Beit Lechol Chefetz Tachat HaShemayim, who talked about let's do this a little easier. Sorry, if I can pull this up side by side.
Let's go. Sorry, Rabbi, did you post, is this source sheet available?
There's no source page. I'm just working off text, so I didn't prepare a source page. I prepared source pages when they're kind of a Rishon and Mefarshim. I just, because I'm working off text, I found it easier to just work off the text on the screen. If you want, I can send you a list of, but they're all text in the chapters. But if you looked is where it began, and then he ended with this phrase, there is accountability for every matter. So this word chayfetz is at the core, beginning and end of the worldview of the Nehenatan in chapter 3. In chapter 5 comes along Kohelet to the Yirei Elokim, and he says, Pasuk Zayin, if you see Oshek Rash V'Gezel oppression, Al Titma Al Achefetz. Same thing, same word. In other words, he's coming back to that same theme. Who is responsible for this world? For tzedek, for justice, for righteousness. To the Amal, it was man. To the Netan, it was God. What's the Elohim's answer? And here he comes up with an answer which seems to be almost gibberish until we decipher his code. Ki gavoa me'al gavoa shomer. I'll just show it to you on that page. Again, this isn't a source page. It's just kind of, I copied and pasted the text to see it side by side. Right? This is, on the right side, you have the words of the Nehenet. Right? There's that word. And God will judge. Where will he judge? Shem. To which the Yirei Elokim's response is, if you see righteous, a perversion of justice, imoshek rash, oppression, etc., al titma ala chayfetz, ki gavoa me'al gavoa shomer. So in contrast to the yishpote Elokim, the notion that God will judge, or to the Amal who said that the king will judge, the answer to the question of accountability, says Kohelet Yirei Elokim, is in this phrase, gavoa me'al gavoa. What is he referring to? So I want to take you through a fascinating journey into the symbol of this phrase, gavoa me'al gavoa. Actually, I can delete that. What does this phrase mean? What does it refer to? Gavoa me'al gavoa. We know that the chapter references the Beit HaMikdash. Clearly. Go back to the last verse of chapter 4, which was the beginning of his speech, when he talked about, right, let's go back to there for a second. Shmor aglecha kasher telech el Beit HaElokim. Guard yourself as you enter the temple. Shlomo built the temple. Shlomo uniquely positioned to understand the role of the temple. And everything in this chapter revolves around the role of the temple. He talks about the Beit Elokim. He talks about Zevach for the first time, sacrifices, whatever sacrifices mean. It's certainly a focus in the Mikdash. He talks about Neder, an oath, which is a temple-related concept. And then he talks about Gavoa Me'al Gavoa. How does the temple connect to this theme of Gavoa Me'al Gavoa, and how does it relate to the question of the oppression? Okay, those are my two foundation questions. I'm going to try to understand, decipher this phrase today. That's our goal. Sort of pull the pieces of this together, then we'll have an extraordinary insight. So to understand what this refers to, we need to know a little bit about the structure of the temple itself. So I'm going to take you into the world of the book of Malachim, Sefer Malachim, Book of Kings, and the construction of the Mikdash. Essentially, when Shlomo built the Beit HaMikdash, he built, I would say, four structures. There are two primary that are going to be our subject, but he built essentially four structures. What are they? He built the temple. He built his palace and his throne room. He built what is referred to as Beit Yara Levanon, a great big hall made out of the wood of the trees of Lebanon. And he built a palace for and home for the daughter of Paro, who was his first wife. Those four structures are all in the complex of the Beit HaMikdash, around which he built an entire wall and single structure unit. It took him 7 years to build the Beit HaMikdash. It took him 20 years to complete the entire structure, 7 years for the temple, and 13 years for the rest of the construction. But if you think about the items that he built, the temple, his palace, the palace of Bat Paro, and this great big hall, which is unclear what its purpose is, but somehow related to the palace is the Beit Yar Levanon. You get a sense from all of these four structures. And he doesn't inaugurate the temple until he finishes the whole thing. So he builds the temple first. It's still closed for 13 more years until he finishes the whole structure. And he opens it all up at once. And you get a sense from that structure that they're all somehow related to the notion of Malchus, the notion of kingship, of the grandeur of kingship. There are also enormous structures. The building structure for that time period is really quite extraordinary. I'm going to start from Malachim Aleph Perek Vav and chapter 6 of the Book of Kings. Vayhi b'shmanim shana, after 480 years from the time we left Egypt. It's one of the anchor points of biblical chronology. 480 years after leaving Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, we call the month Iyar, from Shlomo's reign, he built the house to God. This house which Shlomo built, 60 ama orko, length was 60 amot, esrim rachbo, its width was 20 amot, essentially doubling all the dimensions of the Mishkan, not our subject for now. Ushloshim ama komato, and it was 30 cubits in height. So remember, 30 cubits is more or less between 45 and 60 feet, depending on how you define a cubit, foot and a half to 2 feet. Right? If you imagine it's 60 cubits high, you're talking about, 60 feet high, talking about more or less a 5 or 6 story building in height. And then the Aulam al Pnehe Chalabait, he built a kind of an entrance hall in the presence in the front of the temple, which was 20 amot wide, the width of the building, but it was much higher. Esr ma'amah rochbo pnei habayit, and he builds it all the way up into the heavens. I'm not interested in the entrance hall for now. My interest is in the height of the building. Okay, so amongst the other things that he built was the additional structures, namely his palace. So let's take a look at that for a second. In chapter 7, Ve'et beito banash lomo shalosh esrei shana, the rest of the complex, his house, took him 13 years to build. Ve'even et beit yara levanon, and one of the main structures of this palace was what we refer to as the Beit Yara Levanon, this house of the forest of Lebanon. Me'a ama orko, its length was 100 cubits, chamishim ama rachbo, it was 50 cubits wide, u'shloshim ama komato, and it was 30 cubits high. So what's interesting about that text is that this Beit Yalavanon, this palace of Shlomo that he built, which is connected to his palace, is in fact, it's bigger than the temple, right? It's much bigger than the temple in length and width. But in height, it's exactly the same height as the temple itself. U'shloshim ama komato. And into that structure, he places his throne. So there's much to be talked about, or unpacked, you've all heard Midrashim about this throne of Shlomo. But that is the, those are the two structures that interest me right now. Beit Yalavanon and the temple itself. What's interesting about these two structures, and here is a, I just pulled off some artistic renditions of what this looked like in ancient times. More or less, this is a drawing or an artistic rendition of Ir David. It's a model, actually. Okay, so here you have the Kidron Valley and the Valley of Geben Inom, and this is Ir David. I'm not going to get into the whole details of how Ir David was conquered, but there's a wall that he builds around Ir David. And more or less, this, according to most, if you ever any archaeological digs, if you've ever been to the area in the temple today, the archaeological site around Har HaBayit called the Ophel, if you've been there. If you haven't been there, it's worth going. That's more or less considered to be the remnants of this period of time. The palace and the Beit Yalavanon, more or less structured over here. And of course, Mount Moriah over here. Let's look at, this is a picture, aerial view of Ir David today. This is Har HaBayit today. So here is Har Moriah. This is area here is referred to as the Ophel, which is where the temple on the Ar HaLevanon was, the remnants of it there, and then the rest of Ir David down below. You can kind of see a side view of it from this perspective. Here is a depiction of the temple, 30 cubits high. This is a picture of the throne room, Beit Yalavanon, 30 cubits high, and the palaces over there. So these two structures are exactly the same height. 30 cubits high. Temple here, throne, Beit Yalavanon here. Similarly depicted in this context. However, and you can, this is another view of it, the temple here, the palace or the Yalavanon here, and the rest of Ir David below. So what's fascinating is that these two structures are exactly the same height, 30 amot high. Except for one subtle difference, which is
Kodesh Kadashim.
So that's not the Kodesh Kadashim. That's the entrance hall. The Kodesh Kadashim is in the back of the temple. Kodesh Kadashim is inside.
The temple is elevated on a hill, no?
Yes, correct. Every depiction of the Mikdash places the temple at the top of Har Moriah, and the Beit Yalavanon further down the hill, right? The Ophel, the archaeological digs that we have, which is a big remnant of the Beit Yalavanon, is here down below. Mount Moriah is there above. Similarly from here. Now, if you are living here in Ir David, and you look up at the temple, what do you see? Right? You see, you look up at the palace. It's an enormous structure. You're going to see the Temple of Solomon, and you're going to see the Beit HaMikdash, and they're exactly the same height. So two buildings, one exactly the same height as the other, one's going to block the other from view, except for the fact that the second structure of the Beit Yalavanon is further down the hill. And so when you look up from Ir David, what do you see? If I look at it from the side, I see this, right? I see the temple here and the throne room and the throne room here. But if I look at it from below, from hills, from the city of Ir David, what do I see? To put it in a simple structure schematic, If I look at Solomon's palace here and the temple here, 30 cubits high, and here David below, if I look at it straight on, what I'm going to see is the Mikdash of Shlomo.
But there's an enormous difference in those pictures. If you go to the place, and I've been there many times, this view maybe is relatively accurate, but the other view where that showed them at the roughly the same height and perspective is they're in the wrong place.
Correct.
It's not there. It's way down here.
Correct. That's true. This picture is out of place. It's further down the hill. That's correct. This is a much better. Which one is it? This one is probably a much better view of it. But that just confirms what I'm saying, which is that from the perspective of the people living below, when they looked up the hill, what did they see?
Beis HaMikdash.
They saw two structures. They saw Shlomo's palace and the throne room of Shlomo, and they saw the Beit HaMikdash. But even though they're the same height, because the Beit HaMikdash is further up the hill, and the temple and the throne room is further down the hill, what essentially they're seeing is the top of the temple on top of the throne room of Shlomo. When they're looking up from below, they're looking at the angle makes it so that the temple is actually higher than the Mikdash of Shlomo Melech from the palace of Shlomo, from the perspective of the people down below. Why is that important? And this is at the core of what I'm suggesting, is that the phrase gavoa mi'al gavoa is in fact a reference, it's a code word, for who is responsible for bringing justice in this world. If you were looking at it from the perspective of the Amal, where would you place the burden of responsibility for justice in this world? On the shoulders of, he says it explicitly, on the shoulders of the king, on the Melech. In the building structured known as the court of the throne of the king. If you're looking at it from the perspective of the Nehenatan, where is responsibility for justice in this world? In which structure? In the structure of the Beit HaMikdash. The temple, God. It's God's domain. It's God's problem. It's not my problem. Where is the responsibility in the shoulders of whom? In the worldview of the Yirei Elokim? Gavoa me'al gavoa shomer u'gvohim aleihem. This is a partnership. This is not God's responsibility, and it's not man's responsibility. It's a partnership. Man must do whatever he can to care for the world in which he was put. And at the end of the day, whatever he's unable to accomplish, there is God to both help him achieve that task and also to fill in the pieces that man is unable to do. This is a partnership. And that partnership is the core of the entire message of the Yirei Elokim. It is not man who's responsible for this world, and it is not God responsible for this world. It is a partnership between them. If you see perversion and injustice and violence in this world, don't be dismayed. Take responsibility for it, but you're not ultimately the only responsibility for it. Ki gavoah me'al gavoah shomer u'gvoim aleihem. Look at the temple and look at the Mikdash of the palace of Shlomo HaMelech, and you see them one over the other. From the perspective of the people listening down in the city below, what they're seeing, what they're hearing is, look at that structure. Gavoah me'al gavoah. There's a height of the Mikdash, and it towers over the Mikdash of Shlomo. Shlomo is the king, but the king sits on a throne, but so does God sit on the throne. The Mikdash, more than anything else, is a throne. Mikdash is a palace of the king of kings. We've talked about the Beit HaMikdash in the past. We're going to come back to it many times, but the notion of the Beit HaMikdash, more than anything else, is that it is a throne. What is the Kodesh HaKadoshim? Right, what is the Kodesh HaKadoshim if not a throne room of God? The Aron and the Kuvim make up what we refer to in the Navi Yechezkel as the Merkava, the chariot of God. It is the throne room of God. It is from there that God's voice emanates, and the voice of prophecy emanates from there for man to hear. God is the King of Kings. His word, his authority is in that temple. But there's also the earthly king. There's also the role of Shlomo Melech. There's also the role of man. You can't absolve the human being of responsibility for the world around us. That would be the Nanatan's answer. Says the Amma, you can't do that. Answers the Israel Kim, you're both right.
Is that the brit beinenu between us and Hashem?
It's more than a, yeah, he doesn't talk about the brit, but he talks about the relationship, the partnership, if you will, between us and God, is that that's how God set in place the world. He set the world in a way in which we are responsible for our actions, but we are also partnered with God in this world. We're not going to absolve God of responsibility. We're not going to absolve man of responsibility. It's a partnership. Ki gavoa me'al gavoa shomer. This is one of the most profound lessons, messages of Kohelet, and you'll stay with it through the entire text. The notion that ultimately responsibility for justice in this world cannot be put solely on God's shoulders. That raises the whole question of theodicy and God, and how does the right God let the righteous suffer, and all of the questions, right? Where was, to put it in blunt terms, where was God at the time of, fill in the blank, the Holocaust or every other pogrom ever since or before? That's not the question. Nor is the question only, where is man? Right? The question is, what's the nature of that partnership? Gavoh me'al gavoh shomer. You have Shlomo HaMelech who builds the temple. The temple, he sits on the throne of his father. Shlomo yashav al kisei David aviv. He sat on the throne of his father David. Same verse, exactly the same verse in Divrei Hayomim says, Vayeshev Shlomo al kisei Hashem. Shlomo HaMelech sits on the throne of God. Shlomo HaMelech sits on the throne of man. There's a partnership between God and man. And you know where is that partnership depicted more profoundly than in the image of the temple and Shlomo's palace, one on top of the other. Ki gavoa me'al gavoa shomer. That's the partnership. Okay. Having, from there, we're going to unpack the rest of the parak. But this notion that this idea that Shlomo HaMelech introduces in the words of the Yireh Elokim, this partnership between man and God, that's the core of the whole message of the Yireh Elokim. If you take away anything from this course, you're going to take away this idea. That to Shlomo HaMelech, the notion, the Yireh Elokim's notion of responsibility for the world is the partnership between God and man. That's the Chiddush. I'm going to more or less end here, but I want to share something with you that I came across recently, kind of in amongst the myriad of comments that videos, clips, and discussions and current events that have been going around and inundating all of our inboxes and WhatsApp groups. You know, I'll share with you a personal observation. One of our family WhatsApp groups, we made a decision to only post positive messages, right? No worrisome messages. We kind of wanted to have one thread that was just kind of upbeat inspiring ideas. And in that context, somebody shared with me a post of a 2-minute clip from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, whose third yahrzeit we just commemorated last week. And it speaks to exactly this point of Kohelet, of the partnership between man and God. And so I, forgive me if you've already heard it. If you've heard it, great. If not, I want to play it for you because I think it does a far better job than I could in encapsulating this message, which is at the core of the book of Kohelet. So you'll allow me, I'm going to play for the last 2 minutes of the shiur today, this clip from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Can you all see it and hear it?
Yes, yes.
I asked myself that question as I stood for the first time in Auschwitz-Birkenau, where in the space of a couple of years, 1.25 million human beings, including 250,000 children, were gassed, burned, and turned to ash. Where was God at Auschwitz? And suddenly standing there, the answer came to me. God was in the words, thou shalt not murder. He was there in the words, thou shalt not oppress a stranger. He was there in the words, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And when God speaks and human beings don't listen, there is nothing even an all-powerful God can do. Because if there is one thing he will never do, it is take away our freedom.
No, moments ago.
I call
it staying here.
The faith of the Hebrew Bible, God's call to responsibility. He is telling us, I alone cannot eliminate evil from the world and still allow you to be human, still allow you to be free. Therefore, I need your help in putting out the fire that is consuming civilization in its flames.
That is, I think, the best encapsulation of a short answer to a very complex question, but it revolves around, and I think, exactly what Shlomo Melech is saying here. This is the partnership that he's talking about. Gavoa me'al gavoa, the Melech, the Beit HaMikdash, and the great partnership between God and man that permeates our theology and our sense of and the message of Torah, and certainly the message of Qohelet. And with that, I will stop and answer questions if there are. Otherwise, we will adjourn here and reconvene in 4 weeks, first week of December, because I'm next week, there's a rally in Washington. I won't be able to attend, won't be able to teach. And the 2 weeks after that, I'll be in Israel. So our next class after today will be the first Tuesday in December.